And our speaker tonight is the name is Alan W, but apparently it's W down here. Oh, W, Alan W. I met Alan. I had been about 6 years ago now, at least. And he's used to come around to my home group. He still does. And I've always loved when he shares. Every time in a meeting, he always hits a home run. It always seems inevitable. He's going to say something that's just incredibly awesome. And he also walks the walk. I've seen him. We have a conference room in our home group. And he's always in there working with newcomers. And you always see him. He's doing something. And he goes to Knott's Landing. I see him in Knott's Landing. I see him all around Gwinnett County. So he walks the walk. I've never heard his story, though. And 2 weeks ago, he told his story at our home group, Easy123 in Duluth. And I was down at the Atlanta Roundup, but I got back and I heard wonderful things. So, Alan, you better be good. No pressure. I know where you parked your car. Anyway, I give you Alan W.
Hello, my name's Alan W. And I did park my car outside. Thank you, Sean. And thank you, Ridgeview. I'm honored that you would allow me to be here. I'm actually honored that anybody lets me go or be anywhere, considering the life that I've lived. So this is a rare privilege, and it means a lot to stand behind this desk and to stand in front of you. My sobriety date is November the 15th, 2006, and I'm almost 6 years old. The story began in Washington, D.C., in the early 1960s. I was born there. At least that's what they tell me. I was pretty young at the time, so don't exactly remember. But I had a normal upbringing. I started small and grew. At least that's what they tell me. Again, I was pretty young at the time. I got a joke. I'm going to begin with my spiritual advisor who sits over on that side gave me a joke, so I'm going to share it with you. Is this being recorded? Okay, well, let's cut the joke and go. No, actually, what does an AA meeting and an orgy have in common? I didn't know either. What does an AA meeting and an orgy have in common? With both, you feel good, but you're not sure who to thank. Did I say that right? I can't look over there to see where I get that from. Anyway. Well, the story that you're going to hear is true. The names have not been changed to protect the innocent because, unfortunately, there are no innocents. It's a story about my life, and I am 100% guilty. Guilty of being exactly who and what I am, an alcoholic. I'm not sure if I was born with this gene, this craving, sensitivity to alcohol, but it happened. It's been one hell of a ride. It really has. The first time that that I got drunk was probably in high school. And I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and then we moved around a little bit and ended up in the Maryland area where I went to high school and then later college. And there was this girl that I liked a lot. She was hot. She had beautiful brown hair to her shoulders, and she was just, at the time, you know, way back in the day, I'm an old fart, for those of you that are looking at me. Way back in the day, she was just absolutely stunning, and I wanted to get close to her. I wanted to get very, very close to her, and I tried all kinds of things, but was unsuccessful. So I happened to be at a party one evening, and I was invited to this party because of my induction into a group in high school. We had, I know you've heard of service groups and clubs and whatnot, and you have a teacher who will sponsor a group of young people and then they have a group and they do whatever projects. You know what I'm talking about. I see you nodding your heads. No, maybe you're just sleeping, but no, wake up. Actually, what happened is this group, it was called the Boys Service Club, BS Club for short. No fooling, that's really their name. They inducted me into their group because they were jocks and very popular people, and I didn't do any of that stuff back in high school, even though I was a runner and basically ran to get away from people and things, and that's how I developed my speed. But I'm a musician, and I've been a musician for many years, and so they thought it'd be good to have, a music guy in their club. So they inducted me in, and basically all the BS guys did is they went around from party to party and just broke into parties and drank everybody's beer and acted like a bunch of asses, you know. And I didn't do that yet, but they had me in their club. So we went to this particular party, and everybody was just doing the things that normal high school kids do. And this girl was there, and she was stunning, simply stunning. And I wanted to get close to her, but I had a few beers. And I say a few beers because I really don't remember how many I had, and it was a long time ago. So it could have been 3. It could have been 13. It was more than one, but I don't remember how many, because after a few, the room just started to move and everything started to shift, and it was a very weird experience. I hated the taste of it at first. In fact, I hate beer so much. Hate beer so much that to this day, the smell of beer makes me nauseous. I just absolutely can't stand it. But it did the trick at the time. So I put down a few, and there was this lovely young lady who was near me. And a bunch of us were just kind of hanging and, doing what we do when we're kind of doing this deal. And then as she drew a little closer and I saw that my chance was coming and I had an opportunity to kind of lay my line down on her and, kind of let her know what was up. She looked at me and I looked at her, and I was about to open my mouth and say something extremely sexy and profound and lure her away from the party. And as soon as my mouth opened and my lips parted, out came the results of my drinking all over her. And I hurled... Relax, this is not a family show. Come on. Yeah, and I threw up all over her, and it was a mess. It was just awful. So my chances came and went with a few ounces, and it was a horrible thing. I was drunk. I was absolutely off my rocker, and I don't remember much after that. In fact, people told me a lot of the details. after the fact, the last thing I remember of that evening is that the guys got me back to my basement apartment and had to carry me from the car. I don't even remember where we were, and the town I was in was not very big, and everybody knew everybody, and my parents had been there a long time, so people knew me, and I knew them, but I was completely oblivious. I had no idea where I was. They got me back into my basement apartment, and the only thing I remember other than barfing all over my Queen of Sheba was one of my friends sticking his hand in my pocket to get my key, and I almost ripped his hand off because I thought he was trying to make a move on me since I was inebriated, but that wasn't the case at all. So that was a Chick-fil-A moment brought to you by... No, anyway, just moving on. So after that incident occurred... You can edit that out, can't you? after that event occurred, I was basically okay. I didn't really drink much, and like I say, to this very day, the smell of beer just takes me back to that very unpleasant memory, and so I don't do it anymore. Years went on, and I never really did much of anything until I hit my 20s, which wasn't that far away. My senior year of high school, before I went to college, I was inducted into what's called the High School Musicians Hall of Fame. And that, just one quick commercial here, This is my story, and it's going to be somewhat different from some of yours, and some of the references I will make, while they may sound ostentatious and bragging, they really are not. I come from a musical family. My entire history has been musical. I make my living as a musician now. And so the things I talk about are just how life is. I mean, it really is, and it's not a big deal. But the detail helps you understand who and what I am. So please forgive my arrogance if that's how you perceive it. So anyway, I was inducted in the High School Musicians Hall of Fame, and basically all that meant is you had somebody in the school that liked you a lot and was willing to put your name on something. And so they sent my name in, and I got a nice little yearbook with some of the other musicians that were graduating from high school that year. And from that, I had the opportunity to go on a European tour. So I was a trumpet major in college. We're not there yet, but that was my instrument at the time. And so I got to go on a 12-country tour of Europe as a high school senior. And these were high school musicians and college freshmen and college sophomores. We met in New York City at the New York Statler Hotel, and we were there for about 3 days. Because we had to get all the money together to make this deal happen, and we played symphonic wind literature, grade 5 and grade 6, and that basically means it's college level, kind of hard stuff. So a lot of classical stuff, show tunes, whatnot, and it was a great experience for a young person who aspired to a career in music. So we got to travel, and if you know anything about other parts of the world other than the United States, there is no drinking age. So the story continues. And so once I got to London and some of the other countries, we were encouraged to either drink bottled water because the sanitation system is not the same as it is here in the States, and it's really not advisable to drink anything from the tap. And so we had bottled water, and in some cases, bottled water was more expensive than wine. So it made good economic sense to have... I am a musician. I can count to 8, but not much more than that. So to say good economic sense means something to me. So it made really good sense for us to have wine with our meals. And me being the budding problem drinker that I was, one glass was not enough. It was just the beginning. And so we were allowed to drink and to drink and to drink and to drink. And then once dinner was over, we could continue our drinking any place we wanted in the hotel or wherever we were. And, of course, at the end of concerts, people want to talk to you and say hello. And, oh, nice little young man from the States. And da-da-da-da-da-da. And you're standing around with something in your hand, being very social. And the room was swaying. And, you know, and it was great. So for about 2 months, I got my drink on, you know, as a young guy. And I just threw it back like there was no tomorrow. And it was fabulous, absolutely fabulous. And I threw up a lot, not on any girls, but it was just awful. And I remember one evening we were on a ship, and we were going across the English Channel, and this was the tourism part of the tour. And there was only one bathroom in that end of the ship where we were. And there must have been 18 or 20 rooms that we were sharing. And if you've ever been on a boat and stayed or even toured, you know that the quarters are very, very close. If you've flown on a plane, see how tight the bathroom is? Okay, the rooms are a little bit like that. I mean, it's really, really small, and it's not near as exotic as it sounds. So here we were standing in the hall at 7:30 in the morning using the bathroom, about 15 or 20 of us. And there was only one bathroom at the end of the hall. And you could see the results of a night of partying. There was barf on everybody's face, and all kinds of people had peed on themselves. And it was just a lovely example of young adulthood. It was great. It was so much fun. It really was. It really was. So we did that, and I realized that was not something I wanted to do long-term because it was pretty disgusting because everybody stunk, you know. So we ended the tour and came back, and then I did my freshman year at a music conservatory in the Northeast, and that was wonderful. I had met a lot of great musicians and got to play a lot, had a lot of good teachers, and It was fabulous. I had a great time and was very, very excited about my career until we got to Friday night. And then when we got to Friday night, I did what every college student did, and we drank, and we drank, and we drank. And then Friday turned into Saturday, and Saturday turned to who knows, and it was a mess. It was messed up. I don't want to glorify or romanticize my drunkalogue. I'm sure yours are more illustrious than mine. But I want to tell you the good news of this program. So I am going to tell you what it was like. I will tell you what happened, and I'm going to tell you what it's like now. So just indulge me for another couple minutes just to give you some more detail. The college years passed very quickly, and I left. I was such a good student that it took me 3 schools to get a degree. I just couldn't find my stride. And there were great schools. I had a scholarship to one, lots of loans for another. And then in between the second and the third, I'm confused, I can't count. I actually left and wanted to get a job because I was just sick of school and sick of dealing with all the stuff that goes on in college. So since my mom and dad had a great reputation in the town that we lived, I was afforded the pleasure to the opportunity to be able to go talk to people that I'd grown up with and basically say, this is, you know, young Alan, you remember mom and dad, they did da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm back from college, and I need employment. So I was wondering if we could sit down and kind of talk about what opportunities might be open to me. I did this a few times and got some calls back and met with some people, and it was an amazing thing. I look back on it now, and I realize that my parents' reputation carried me, because my mom and dad were just stellar, still are to this day, stellar people. And because of the sacrifices they made and how well they raised us, despite how I turned out, I had an unbelievable opportunity. And it's an amazing thing to have somebody create a job for you, simply because you're the son and daughter of somebody else. And I've got children now, and I think about their careers and their lives, and I think, man, I had it so good. I had it so good. But my relationship with my father was not very good. In fact, in my high school years, I'll tell you a quick story. In my high school years, my parents left the state and had an appointment somewhere else. I was not going to go. I wanted to finish my high school education there. And while I remained, I was living with a family, and this family knew me real well, knew how I'd been raised and whatnot, and so it was a very loose environment, put it that way, because they trusted me. But man, I just took full advantage. I snuck out all hours of the night and all kinds of cranny stuff, and one weekend they went away for a conference. The entire family left, and I was left at home. And so I went to the guys in the BS Club, Boys Service Club, and said, hey, let's get some service together. You know, that was kind of our code. And basically that meant let's throw down a party. So we made up some flyers and started calling people. Now, this was before internet, so I couldn't send out a mass email or go on Facebook and have a bunch of people be notified. I had to go actually call people on the phone with a dial phone, you know, and pass out flyers and all this. I had to actually do some work. And I remember putting on the flyers, it's going to be the party of the century at Alan's house. And everybody's, oh, yeah, man, Alan's cool. We're going to go to Alan's house. It's going to be awesome. Yeah, great. So me being the good manipulator that I am, I knew that it might get out of hand, so I wanted to make sure I covered my bases. So I went to the neighbors to the right and left of our house and a few across the street and said, hey, I'm going to have a few friends over this weekend, so it might be a good idea for you to go to dinner or maybe a late movie, and it won't be too rowdy, but you know how young kids are and everything, and I just want to let you know just to be courteous because we've been neighbors for a long time. Oh, Alan, what a great young man you are. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. How's your mom and dad? Da-da-da-da-da. Oh, they're fine. Thank you. Well, have a great time. Oh, you kids are just great. My bases were covered. It didn't stop there. There were some police officers that used to tour our neighborhood on a regular basis. And so I made it a point to reach out to 2 particular cops. I knew them well. They'd seen me run up and down the streets. And wave at them. So I remember stopping one of them and said, "Hey, man, I just want you to know that next Friday night we're going to have a little party over at my house. Just, you know, a few friends, you know, from the band and whatnot." And so it would be a huge help to me if you guys would kind of just drive around and just let us know that you're there, you know, keep everything cool. Would that be okay? "Oh, sure, Alan, how's it going? How's mom and dad? And, you know, you're a good kid. They raised you well and whatnot." "Thanks so much. I really, really appreciate that. So I'll see you sometime Friday night." "Oh, sure, don't worry, but worry about it." They never showed up at all. And I knew they wouldn't. They just wanted a little courtesy. I then went to the police station and made the exact same pitch to make sure that everybody knew what was happening. In the event there were any calls in, they knew it was Alan's party and they could say, "Yeah, we've got it under control. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine." So I covered my bases and I had my friends come over and we moved everything out of the house, all the furniture, put it in one of the back rooms, had some on the back porch, and moved the china closet out and just made sure everything was clear so there wouldn't be any issues going on. And the BS Club, Boy Service Club, brought the kegs over, and we got ready. And before you knew it, there was probably 250 people descending on my little house, you know, about the size of this room, a little bit more. And I was freaked, just absolutely freaked. And I was so overwhelmed that I didn't drink at all that night. You know, I couldn't. I was micromanaging details and people here and there, just trying to keep everything straight and just going out of my mind, just overwhelmed what was happening, because I just did not expect to see so many people and didn't know what was going to happen. And as I was managing around the party, I remember going downstairs to my room, my basement apartment. Oh, the coffee's cold. Yeba. Tastes like beer. No, it doesn't. And when I went down to my bedroom, I got the shock of my life. Because when I opened the door and pulled open the curtain, had a nice, you know, kind of, you know, atmosphere going on there with black lights and all this kind of, I saw a guy and a girl in my bed. And when I saw them in my bed, I just freaked. I hit the roof and was ready to viscerate somebody, you know. I was just completely beside myself. So that was the end of the party. Out, everybody out. That's it. Get out of my house. So I threw everybody else out of the house, and within 25-30 minutes the place was absolutely empty except for the deluge of garbage that was everywhere. Bottles and all kinds of stuff, clothing and just everywhere. Guys had pissed in the bushes and they trampled on the flowers, and it was a mess. I didn't know how I was going to clean this up. So me and the guys got busy, and we worked really hard and did the best we could and tried to get things together and got it all vacuumed and got everything pulled back and thought it was fine. And then I tried to sleep it off and was just frantic. You know, the family comes home and, you know, "How you doing?" "Oh, good. How was the weekend?" "Everything's quiet. Everything's great. You guys have a good conference?" "Oh, I had a great time. Yeah, da, 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 whatnot." Well, they had this little shit of a little crappy young guy. Sorry about the tape there. Who was probably 10 or 11 at the time, and he was a real Urkel, real nutty professor type. You know, just an animal as he could be. And you know, he didn't miss any detail. Not a detail. I mean, he was a very sharp, very smart young guy. And he walked around the house and started to notice that things were a little out of place. He went to the china closet and said, "Hey, Mom, something's wrong. This plate used to be over here." Hmm. And then she came over and looked, and they started to realize that the punch bowl was also in the wrong place. I had delegated that to somebody else while I was doing other details and did not realize that they didn't know where it went. So the jig was up. I was found out. I was caught. So they confronted me, and I said, "No, nothing happened. Everything was fine." And they looked down on the carpet, even though it was vacuumed. You know, heavy furniture has a way of making imprints on the rugs. Little detail I missed. They saw that the furniture had been moved. So they went outside and they looked in the trash cans, and where I lived, and at that time, the neighborhoods had alleys, and so you'd had the trash trucks drive behind to pick up the garbage. So they went there, and I covered every base except for taking out the trash. And there it was, piles and piles of beer bottles and everything else, and, you know, I was busted. So they did the thing I feared most. They called my father, and he spoke to me on the phone. And my parents are Afro-Caribbean Hispanics. I grew up in a bilingual home, and my dad has an unbelievable temper, the likes of which has been damaging. I proceeded to talk to my father on the phone, and he tore me a new one, and it was painful. It was, I've been spanked. I'll use that politically correct term. I've been spanked before, but what he said to me on the phone was more devastating than anything I'd ever felt. And I was crushed. I was absolutely crushed, and didn't know what I was going to do. So I left the house and went for a run, and my mind was just racing, and I was in pain. I was in nine kinds of pain, and just didn't know how to cope. Even back then, I didn't have good coping mechanisms, and just didn't know how to manage life at all. And I found myself on a busy street, probably the likes of the road out here. Back at the time, and there was a bridge, or overpass, I guess you'd call it. And so I went out on the overpass that was overlooking this road, and I threw my legs over the side and stood on the edge, and I figured that if this is what my life had come to at under 19 years old, then there wasn't much life left to live. I didn't know about alcoholic thinking, the extremes, didn't know about that, but that's just the space I lived in all the time. There was no gray, it was just extremely black or extremely white. And what I'm about to tell you is absolutely true as best as I can recall. I don't expect you to believe it. I don't really care. This is my story. But as God is my witness, I threw my legs over the side and looked over as I saw the cars racing backwards and forwards, four lanes of traffic, and I held the back end, and I looked up, took a couple of deep breaths, and then I let go. And I let go and felt myself move forward. And as I moved forward, I heard a voice. This always happens. And I heard a voice speak to me as clearly as I hear my own voice right now. And the voice said to me, son, you don't have to live like this anymore. And then the strangest thing happened. For a split second, while I was hearing that voice and feeling the inertia of gravity as I let go of the rail behind me, I found myself floating in midair. For all intents and purposes, I should have fallen off the bridge. But something paused, and I was just stuck. I was stuck just long enough to be able to reach back, catch myself, get my footing. And when I did that, I flipped around and was hanging by my hands with my feet over the side. And that's all the people in traffic needed. And then they started stopping, and a big commotion happened, and I had a couple people help me up. And before the police arrived and we really got in big trouble, I got myself up and said, hey, everything's fine, everything's okay. I slipped. I appreciate your help. And I darted off, and I left. It was after that I went to Europe and tried to forget the whole experience. A few years passed, and as time went on, I tried to let that whole experience just go away. Didn't really understand the significance of it. What I realize now is that I experienced things in my life and in my development that the significance of which I did not really understand until time had passed. I didn't understand the significance of that moment, hearing that I didn't have to live like that anymore. I left school, got a job, and the job I got was actually working at a rehab center, strangely enough. And at the time, it was kind of a new thing in the North of Virginia area. This particular facility was about $14 million. It was big and beautiful. It was written up in the newspaper and the press, and it was the shining example of a man helping man, society working for those who were the down and outers. And it was an inpatient treatment center, and I was part of the counseling staff. I didn't know a first thing about counseling. But I was a musician, and it was a religiously based group, and basically my job was to be the in-house musician, you know, for the midweek and Sunday worship services, and they let me do whatever else I wanted during the week and called it part of counseling. And I got to meet some people. I met a guy, his name was John D. He's now gone, but he was the first wet brain I'd ever met. I didn't even know what a wet brain was. At the time, John was about 38 years old. He was disheveled. He was much taller than I was. He had a belly that looked like he was malnourished. His beard was salt and pepper colored and spotty. It didn't come in full. His teeth were, well, there were no teeth. There was stuff in his mouth, but they weren't teeth. And he had a laugh that was kind of like a Santa Claus. He was a very, very jolly kind of fellow, except for the fact that he shook uncontrollably when he laughed and when he moved and when he talked. And one of my main jobs was to get John from his room upstairs on the second floor to the elevator, get him downstairs, get him through the food line, and get him to a chair, and sometimes sit there with a napkin and wipe his mouth as he ate. John was an alcoholic. So it was there I was first exposed to AA. And I was there just learning and observing and had the opportunity to counsel people and didn't know anything about counseling, but they taught me as I went. And so I got to kind of facilitate what was going on there in the community life at the treatment center. And I learned a lot of things. I learned about higher power, which I thought was foolishness. I learned about the 12 steps, which is crap. I thought the people were just losers and they just needed to get a life. And on my off hours, I had a very, very nice apartment in a beautiful place. They helped me get my first car. And in my off hours, I would sneak in and out of the window of my apartment, and I'd go drink with the administrator's son, and we would just terrorize Northern Virginia. Everybody knew us. We were bad boys. We had a great time. And I'd sneak girls into my apartment and add notches to my gun and developed a nickname. They used to call me the hoe. They called me the hoe because I could do my deal, man. It was a beautiful thing. At least so I thought. And this went on for a long time. And what I didn't know at the time is I was basically eroding my soul, having a great time as a young guy, but I was doing things that I was going to have to pay the tab for later on. So I kept doing it and kept doing it. One particular evening, and this is a story I've never told in public before. Oh, man. This is tougher than I thought. One particular evening, I was downtown in the city, and I was at a club. I'll call it a gentleman's club, but you know what I mean. And there wasn't a gentleman in sight. Nowhere. But we had a great time, and I was throwing them back, having a great old time with a fistful of dollars, and everybody knew my name, and it was wonderful. It was absolutely fabulous. And I was having a great time and kept drinking, and everything was going great as much as I thought it was. And then I decided that I wanted to improve the evening. So I called up a guy. He met me outside, and we exchanged things. And I'll stay with the singleness of purpose, but the evening continued, and I was in better states from adding to my evening, so to speak, enhancing it. But I got the great idea that that wasn't enough, and I wanted to add more notches to my gun. And there I was around all these lovely ladies, so I figured, you know, it's probably time one of them meet me. So I had the great idea to try to arrange a date, but instead of doing it the normal way, I waited outside for one of the ladies at the end of the evening. The sun hadn't come up yet, and I recognized her. Followed her to her car, and as I got close enough to her, I put my hand over her mouth, and she spun around and looked at me, and I gripped her tightly. Next thing I know, she screamed, kicked me, yelled, and started fighting, and I freaked out and ran. I had every intention of being dishonorable, and I'll put it that way. Then the next thing happened, which shook me to my very core. I was less than two blocks away from that incident, and I saw flashing lights, the colors different in the state that I was in. But two police officers got out of the car. One drew his revolver. The other one drop-kicked me in the chest. I landed flat on my back. He put his foot on my throat, and then there's a revolver sitting right in my mouth. And he asked me what I was doing. And he asked me what kind of drugs I was on and who my contacts were. And he told me I was going to jail. And that shook me to my core. I was more scared that night than I'd ever been in my entire life. And a gun doesn't taste too good. But you know, I'm pretty smooth. So by the time they let me up, because they did want to hear what I had to say, I denied everything. They even told me what had happened. I said, you know, the lady's mistaken. I've never seen her before in my life. Do I look like the kind of person? Do I talk like the kind of person that would conduct themselves in that manner? I mean, really, officer, look at me. And then I looked at his badge. His name was Officer J. Catone. I read his badge number. I still remember it to this day. And as I read his name and his badge number, I said, I wonder what your supervisor would say if I shared with him the excessive force that you used in this engagement. Perhaps we need to reconvene at your office. And he said, well, this is a warning, young man. You need to get your life together. And I got off. When you spend a lot of time in front of people, as I did for so many years, it just doesn't take long. It becomes a natural thing to manipulate and control and smooth people over. It just happens. But what I didn't realize is that was just one of the attributes of my alcoholism, one of the symptoms of my disease. I was a manipulator, a liar, and a cheat, and I took and I stole anything I wanted from anybody. It just didn't matter. And it was just a matter of time before I could get in your mind and get in your heart and anywhere else I wanted, because that's what I do, drunk or sober. Well, the story went on, and we'll fast forward many, many years. I left that area, moved south down here with y'all, and got a career in the church. And I was involved in a very large church in the city of Atlanta. I was there for years, and while I was there, my disease caught up with me, and I was found out. And as a result of that, I had to leave my position. And in leaving my position, because I was a very high-profile person, it was my responsibility to give a public confession in front of upwards of 3,000 people. It was devastating. It was humiliating. I left. My life completely changed. Completely changed. I had never been in a position where I was second, third, one among many, unable to use my natural gifts to get whatever I want. I had to stand in line. That was terrible. But I got a sales job, and I started selling. Started working for a company and did very, very well. I used my natural ability, my manipulation, to get into offices and to sit down with CEOs and to make presentations to them. And before you know it, I had a national sales territory, and I was traveling and I was flying 80% of the time. I was on a plane somewhere around the United States going to Vegas, which is a synonym for hell. I hate Vegas, because every time I've gone to Vegas, I've fallen, and I've fallen hard. I can't resist. I can't resist. And while I was doing all that, everybody there drank the same way I did, and it was a beautiful thing. We just threw it back and got very close with the executive level of the company, and they made concessions for me, and we helped each other out, and it was a great thing. And commission checks, that's a thing from God. Ooh, baby. Sweet. Seeing all those zeros just gave me permission to do whatever I wanted. And we lived high on the hog, high on the hog, as you can tell. I like nice things. And then one evening, went out with my family, and I'd been drinking, but that was always the case. And we went and just had a family activity. And since I'd spent so much time as a musician, I never learned to ride a bike or skate. So believe it or not, we went skating, and I fell and broke my ankle. Yep, for all you jocks in the house, you can go ahead and laugh. Go ahead, laugh, yep. I went roller skating and broke my ankle. So I had my very first surgery at the age of 37 years old. Spent a night in the hospital. They put me on drugs, OxyContin, I think it was. And I've not done a lot of, outside issues, but I tell you, I hate that stuff. It sucks. It just freaking sucks. The room started spinning. The carpet started talking. The chairs were rubbing me on my face. You know, it was awful. It was terrible. It was the strangest trip I ever had in my life. And I immediately put it down. Called the doctor and said, I can't do this. This stuff's not working for me. I absolutely can't do this. Well, what about the pain? Well, I'll just take Advil or Tylenol or something like that. So, well, if you need anything else, just let us know and we'll write you a prescription. Okay, I appreciate that. But this stuff is terrible. You got to get it off the market. Yeah. So instead of doing that, I drank more. And I drank more. And actually, the way I got around my family is I told them that Daddy needed his medicine. So my kids, who were small at the time, would go pour glasses of alcohol for me and bring it to me as I sat in my chair with my leg propped up. And they would bring multiple glasses to me before dinner, after dinner, during dinner. I'd even bring it up to my bedroom because, you know, I couldn't walk downstairs. And I found a way to shift the situation to work in my behalf. That kept going, kept selling, kept making money. And my drinking increased to a epidemic level in my mind, probably not for some of you since, you know, I'm a newbie. But one afternoon, I'd been drinking since 7 o'clock in the morning, and towards the end, I was drinking 24/7, very early in the morning, very late in the night, sometimes through the night. And I'd been drinking about 7 o'clock in the morning and working at home. Since I was my office was basically the airport, and then the corporate office, and then I had my office in the house, and it was my turn to go pick up my daughter from school. She was attending a private school at the time, and it was about 3:30 in the afternoon. I got onto the parking lot, and I'd been drinking. I actually had a beverage in the car with me in a Quick Trip cup, so nobody could tell what it was. And I got into an accident in the parking lot of the school. Banged into a guy. So I get out of the car and I start to argue with this fellow. Didn't he see where he could, why didn't you see where you were going? And what I was trying to get out, and got my kid in the back of the car, and basically I was saying, don't you know who I am? You know, and I was stammering and just, you know, not doing very well. And he's kind of looked at me like I was an idiot, a police officer. He motioned for him to come over, and I thought, uh-oh, here's a cop. So I need to turn this one around. So I began to wax eloquently about the boulevard rule and the right of way and all other kinds of legal junk that I'd heard on late night TV. And the cop looked at me and said, sir, all I need are the facts. Please go back to your car. So I turned around, went back to my car, and felt good because I got over on him. He had no idea I'd been drinking. One more time, it worked. Or so I thought. I experienced things in my life that I didn't really gain the significance of it until much, much later. I turned around from that incident and I looked in the backseat of the car, and there was my daughter, probably 9 or 10 at the time, pigtails, private school uniform, sitting in the back of the car, curled up like a ball, crying her eyes out, heaving, scared to death. I flung open the back of the car and reached out to her to comfort her, and she recoiled from me. And I paid the tab for it. My child, my baby girl. I'd like to say that that was the last time I drank, but it wasn't. I got her back home and had to get a tongue lashing from my wife. And horrible things ensued. That's what it was like. And I took far too much time to do that. Please excuse me. What happened is some people told me that I needed some help. I had an ultimatum from my wife. She wasn't going to leave. I wish she would. but she wasn't going to leave. She just actually pressed me and got me in front of some people that I respected and told them what had been going on. I was completely oblivious. She actually called a meeting with some people that were, I'm big into mentoring, and a couple of guys that were mentors of mine, and thought we'd just kind of get together to talk. And then she basically gave them a chronology, and they looked at me with these piercing eyes and just held my feet to the fire. And I knew I had to do something. So started to find AA, Googled it, found some meetings, found one in Duluth, found one at a hospital, and started going. And went to these rooms and saw you people and thought, you've got to be kidding. There's no way. I'm not like this. They're beneath me. No way. I'll do this for a little bit, then I'll leave and everything will be fine. And then the more I stayed and the more I listened, I started to discover that you were not beneath me. You were me. And in some respects, you were my superiors because you were sober and I wasn't. And I remember talking after a meeting, during a meeting, and a gentleman came up to me at the very end, and he was just a loud-mouthed New York son of a awful, bleep, 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 bleep. You know, he was just, hated this guy. And he just looked at me. He looked at me and he said, you got a sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? He said, come with me. So over at the clubhouse where we meet at, there's a back room there, a little conference room area. And we went together, and he opened up the book, and he started reading a few pages and asked me some questions. I was like, yeah, sure, well, whatever. And he said, he read a few more things. He said, you ready to do this? Do what? So you ready to do this thing? Okay. So we knelt down. We knelt down on the couch. And this guy took my hand. I was ready to beat the crap out of him. Don't touch me. And we said the third step prayer. And as harsh and as gruff as this man is, in a very intimate, innocent, peaceful voice, he said these words. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as you wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that victory over my difficulties may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, of thy love, and of thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I heard those words, and something broke inside me, and my life started. It was almost like a defibrillator was kicked off in a heart. This guy then started to pour into me over the next 12 months. He started to teach me. I'd call him on the phone. I'd throw up. He'd say, stop right there. Read page so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. I'd call him every day. I'd throw up. He'd say, stop right there. Read so-and-so and so-and-so. And after a while, I was like, what is this? Why do they say call your sponsor? It should be listen to your sponsor, because he doesn't give me time to say anything. He always cuts me off. 45-minute conversations, he's going on and on and on and on, and like, what? But I needed that, and he was what we call a Nazi sponsor, because I didn't know crap. I didn't know shit. And I needed to be taught. Yeah, there are suggestions. No, they weren't. These were edicts. These were commands. That's exactly what they were. And you know, it's exactly what I needed, because my life was going nowhere fast. I was killing myself and everybody else around me, and I needed help, and I didn't know what help I needed. So I needed somebody who was going to strong-arm my ass, and that's exactly what he did. He pushed me. He pressured me. I remember taking a fourth step with this guy, and I went on the internet and found a form. I'm working on computers a little bit. Found a form instead of writing it out and started filling stuff out and typing it real fast and whatnot, and I showed it to him one day. Hey, man, take a look what I did. He said, where'd you get this? I said, oh, I got it off the internet. He ripped it up right in front of me. He said, get a pen and a piece of paper and get in touch with your frickin' life. Oh, yeah? Yeah. You want to step outside, man? Come on. Yeah, that's what he did. He was a Nazi. But I thank God for that man. By the time he got me to my one-year anniversary, I was so excited and so elated because I thought I was going to die drunk. This thing had me so tight. A friend of mine who's passed on used to say it had me by the short hairs, but This thing had me so completely and so totally that there was no hope. I was not getting out of this thing. I envisioned myself wrapped around a tree, dead, every day of my life for more than 10 years. I was an alcoholic times 10. I could not stop drinking. I didn't even want to stop drinking. I didn't want to stop drinking. I just wanted to die, but I couldn't even do that. And I remember standing at Knott's Landing in 2006, November 15th, and they handed me my chip. And he said, he's worked real hard this year. I'm happy to give you your chip. He gave me a hug. And then I heard other people, and I knew it was my time to say something. And I thought through what I was going to say. I had my 3 points and a joke and knew what I was going to open up with, and I had my mad skills I was going to come out with and impress everybody. And I got this huge lump in my throat. And then my lips parted. And next thing I know, I just blurted out with a song. I started to sing. Because I couldn't believe that I was sober. Just couldn't believe it. And I was. I was sober for 1 year. I drank for over 25 years. And there wasn't an ounce of alcohol in my body at that time. That's what happened. I got in touch with the God of my understanding, and I had lots of religious training. I got truckloads of crap. I could debate you all day long, and you would lose. But that didn't matter, because the bridge was out from my brain to my heart. I couldn't get the information down where faith and belief and hope actually reside, because the bridge was out. And I was dead. I was dead on the inside. I came and I listened. I did service work. I talked to people. I then had the privilege to start sponsoring men. And it is the greatest honor of my life to have spiritual sons. The book says that this is something you must not miss. And that's true. There is no greater joy or elation to be able to share with another man what has hurt you so deeply, what you are so ashamed of, that you'd wish nobody would ever hear about. And then to know that there's a God of your understanding that can remove that hurt as far as the east is away from the west, and you can be clean. It's unbelievable. There's a lady, her name is Michelle W. She goes to one of the rooms that I frequent, and she told me she's got close to 30-something years. And I remember one afternoon she looked at me and she looked at me and she said, "You know something, Alan? If you really try, you can go as deep as you want to in this program. It'll take you down to the very core of your soul, and you can be completely remade." She said that to my face. I was 90 days sober, and I was going to drink. My knees were buckling. I just couldn't hang in there anymore. My skin was crawling. I was crazy, absolutely crazy. And a lady, her name is Carrie, at my home group, this tall, powerful little lady, just a sweetheart. She asked me at the end of the meeting, "What's wrong with you, sugar?" I said, I don't know. I'm coming apart." And she reached up, took my face in her hands, and of course she had to pull me down to her level. And she looked at me, almost got nose to nose, and she said, "Baby, I believe in you. You're going to make it." I had somebody pour into my life. I had a gentleman, he's got close to 35 years, his name is Tom. He's a very distinguished old gentleman with white hair, sits on the right-hand side of the room over there at Knott's, where I call the elder statesman. And I was also 90 days sober, 93, 94 days, and he came to me and he gave me a little book, the 24-hour-a-day book, and he signed the inside of it with his name and he gave it to me. I still have it today. It sits on my desk in my office in my house. People have made an investment in me. They cared. They believed. They took time. They shared. I stand here today not because I'm good at all, because there really is a higher power, and he shows up in people just like you all over these rooms, all over this city. And those two specific people nursed me back to health, and many, 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 many others. Alcoholism is a bitch. Alcohol is a serious, vicious foe. It is a disease. not long ago, I came to terms with my addiction. I remember hearing a tape from a gentleman who laid out for the first time in my hearing the disease concept of addiction and alcoholism. And he explained that I have a disorder in the hedonic system of my brain. That basically means the pleasure center. The switch is broken, and I don't perceive pleasure the right way. I don't get pleasure from normal things, holding hands, walking in the park, seeing somebody succeed. Therefore, my pleasure has got to be over and above, way over the top, excessive, bigger than life. That's the only way it registers, because there's something broken in my brain. There's something biologically different in me. I am an alcoholic. I am an addict. I'm broken on the inside. But the God of my understanding has showed me a way to hedge that bet. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Then I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care keeping of God as I understood him. And then I took that fearless moral inventory and I shared it with somebody else. Then I asked them to dig all the crap out of me, dig it out, root and branch. And you know how that happened? On my knees. You know how that happened? Smoking on the couches at places like Easy and Knots and other rooms. You know how that happened? Working with a guy. It happened eyeball to eyeball, nose to nose, face to face with you. That's when recovery begins, and that's the process I've been engaged in for almost 6 years. And that's how my life got jump-started. That's what has happened to me. I started to discover that the only way I could balance out this pleasure problem I have was to fully invest myself in the lives of others. I had to find something that was so significantly meaningful and deep to me. Not to you, not to anybody else. It meant so much to me that it was almost at the level of being spiritual. It resonated with my soul. And what is that? Watching you recover. Hearing about your shortcomings and your failures. Watching you succeed. Being in the meetings and watching and hearing you cry. Standing outside of clubhouses and being a shoulder for men and women to lean on as they cry, and hearing about their pains and their discomfort, and empathizing and walking the road of recovery with them, and knowing that if you can make it, I can make it. Entering into other people's stories has kept me sober, because that's when I see God. Let me tell you what it's like now in the closing moments. Need to pass the basket and take up an offering after this sermon, don't we? One of the things that my first sponsor had me do, he had me read the vision for you. And I thought that was pretty strange. I hadn't even taken the fourth step yet. I guess he was just sick of hearing me whine and complain about how bad my life was. And he wanted to put in front of me a vision that I could move towards. And it painted a picture for me of what life could be like without alcohol. I say today that I don't have a drinking problem. I have a living problem. What I don't know how to do is to live without alcohol. And that's what my sponsor coaches me on. The things we talk about, not drinking. That's past right now. His coaching sessions with me are about everyday decisions about life without the bottle. And in a vision for you, I learned that I could be a different man. I learned that things could change. And let me tell you how much things have changed for me. I have a small company, the name of which you don't know, and it doesn't really matter. But since the end of April, I have been in Italy, near Milan. I have traveled to Poland and Berlin. And less than 3 weeks ago, I got back from Nairobi, Kenya. My life has so radically changed, so completely changed, that I'm afforded the great opportunity to work with musicians all over the world. Not because I'm good, not because I'm talented, not even because I'm sober, but because there's a God of my understanding that gives good gifts to his people and good gifts to his children. And I believe that alcoholics and addicts are his special children. And what I do when I travel, I see people that are broken. I see people who are in third world contexts. And I coach and I train artists on how to give back all over the world. Just a few days ago, I had a meeting with the city manager in the area where I live. And we had a very detailed, high-level conversation about how we can serve our city. One of the things I realized when I was traveling on my last trip is I do a lot of things in other places, but I do very little service for my community. I serve in AA, but I do very little outside. And it gripped my heart, and I recognized, I heard the voice of my higher power that's not good enough. I need to be giving back in every possible way that I can. So I called this guy up, sat down with him, bought him lunch, and we talked. And I don't know what's going to come from it, but I at least made the effort to reach my hand out and say, I want to help. Can you show me how? Now, I'm not telling you that to impress you. I'm telling that to impress upon you that regardless of how much time you have or wherever you are in your journey of recovery, it doesn't matter. The God of my understanding, the God of your understanding, will take you from where you are to the heights of contribution. Your story will become your greatest asset because mine has. My brokenness and my fallenness and my depravity and my sickness sometimes is a point of shame, but it's the greatest resume I have because I know that there is nothing good in me. I don't have anything to give except to tell the story about how this God has done for me what I could not do for myself. Spirituality is extremely important to me because spirituality is the whole reason that I live. And that's not about being preachy. It's not about quoting anything. It's not about even talking to people. Some people like to say that spirituality is a very private thing. Therefore, one should not talk about it in a public setting, much less impose one's views on another individual. And I wholeheartedly agree, except to one point. Spirituality is personal, but never private. Because what you believe comes out. Who we are on the inside is demonstrated to everybody around us. I know that painfully from my own story. I thought and fully understood that I was hiding, but that wasn't the case. And when I knelt down in that room and my sponsor said the third step prayer with me, he looked up at me when we got done and he said these words, "You never have to live like this again." He said to me the same words I heard as a young teenager on the bridge when I tried to take my life. So nobody can tell me that there's not a God. Nobody can tell me that there's no higher power. If you don't have one, try mine. I need to stay in recovery because I'm still very, very sick. It's been a little while since I've had a drink, but I'm still me. And I'm dangerous. So I've got to be around people who have what I want. And the only way to get that is to let it rub off by osmosis. Hang around the winners and let it rub off. Talking and sharing with people who have the things in their lives that I want to manifest, sharing with them. That's how I stay better. That's how I stay sober. I'm glad to be here with you, and I'm so honored that you allow me to speak to you, but you need to realize you are the ones that are giving the lesson. You're the ones that are giving the greatest talk because this is your life. And you are here doing normal, everyday stuff that keeps you sober. And that's what I need to see. That's what I need to hear because it encourages me to keep going. In conclusion, if you'll allow me, I'd like to express something to you just the way I do. as sincerely and as heartfelt as I can. I want you to walk away with this one thought. I need you, you need me. We're all a part of God's body. Stand with me, agree with me. We're all a part of God's body. It is His will that every need be supplied. You are important to me. I need you to survive. I need you. You need me. We're all a part of God's body. Stand with me, agree with me. We're all a part of God's body. It is His will that every need be supplied. You are important to me. I need you to survive. You are important to me. I need you to survive. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. That was so powerful. Yeah, and it's true. We can all do this together.